Well, following up on the discussion we've just had about the budget, about whether or not it'll get the economy back to normal, let us wonder whether perhaps we're selling ourselves short by simply aiming for a restoration. Now, before the pandemic, Australia and the world were plagued by shattering unemployment, climate change, accelerating inequality, and also considerable amounts of hunger. And according to a suite of leading Australian thinkers, if we make the right choices now, we could build a better, more equitable nation. How does that grab you? Emma Dawson is Executive Director of the progressive think tank Per Capita, and Janet McColman is an award-winning author and historian. Now, together, they've put together a new book which features pretty good essays by a range of clever people and sets out a progressive agenda to restore our economy and tackle the twin crises of climate change and inequality. The title, What Happens Next? Reconstructing Australia After COVID-19. And I'm delighted that Emma and Janet join us now to tell us more about it. Unfortunately, unlike Laura, this is a virtual discussion, but I welcome you both to the Little Wireless program. You've heard Laura's analysis of the budget there. But before we turn to your book, what do you hope happens after the pandemic? Can you give me your thoughts, Emma?
Thanks, Philip. It's lovely to be with you on your Little Wireless program, to which I have listened for many, many years. What we hope happens next is a big national conversation about how we can reconstruct an Australia from the ashes of this pandemic, if you like, that is more forward-looking, more progressive, more inclusive and sustainable. So even before this crisis arrived, as you alluded to earlier, there was, I think, a great need to rethink what kind of country we want to be and to take a much more deliberate approach to crafting a society and an economy that works for all of us and restores some of those values that we say we hold dear, but we've seen slip away over the last couple of decades.
But Emma, there didn't seem to be much of that sort of thinking in the budget we've been discussing.
No, unfortunately not. And I think Laura's analysis is on budget night and just then as well is pretty spot on. It was a very short-term, temporary targeted budget aimed at an immediate crisis and certainly focused on – it was much more Reaganomics than Keynesian, I think, in that it was focused on supporting business and a supply-side solution to what is a
demand-side. But we have, of course, a treasurer who has already cited Maggie Thatcher. As his hero.
Yes, indeed. And actually in the conclusion of the book that I wrote, I take umbrage with that very ideology and say that if there's one thing this pandemic has revealed to us, it is the lie of Maggie's famous aphorism that there is no such thing as society, because in truth we have seen there's nothing else. We're all deeply interconnected and reliant upon one another. And so I see this, and Janet does as well, I know, as a moment of transformation which come along in societies every so often, and we see this as crisis as an opportunity for change.
I raised the issue of the budget's mistreatment of women. This is something I know you feel very strongly, that that the unemployment for women in this COVID-induced economic collapse is double that of the 1990s recession.
That's right. So in the 1990s recession, women made up about 25% of job losses, and they're slightly over 50% today. And that just reflects a couple of things. First, the changing nature of our labour market in the intervening years. So we are a lot less reliant on manufacturing now than we were in the early 90s and certainly in the 80s, and a lot more reliant on service industries and the so healthcare and social assistance, which is something else Laura mentioned. But also a lot of those other industries in which women are employed in often part-time and casual jobs that they fit around their domestic labour, their caring responsibilities, so roles in hospitality, retail, services, entertainment, and of course tertiary education, that have been really badly affected by this pandemic. And yet the government seems to have proposed a solution that would have done very nicely for the 1992 or 1990s recession, but not so nicely for today.
Janet, at what point were you wildly applauding last night?
Last night?
I'm sorry, over the budget,
Over the budget. I really wasn't, actually, Philip. I really couldn't find anything to get wildly excited over. I think it's extraordinarily unfair to expect the private sector to do all the heavy lifting. The government's turned into leaners. They're not taking up their responsibilities. The concern that started this whole project came from discussions we were having with John Langmore, who's one of the contributors to the book. And John was the member for Fraser in 1983 and was one of the key architects of the Accord as a young economist, previously working for Ralph Willis. And what we began to think about was, how do you actually make change in a country as conflicted as we are? And we came back to the idea of an accord as an Australian solution.
Janet, before we focus on this, and I think I agree with you, it's of vital importance, I just want to walk it back a little, because one of the things you say, with which I wholeheartedly agree, is that this country arguably had the best government in history under Prime Ministers Curtin and Chifley. So what can we learn from post-war reconstruction?
Well, the really interesting thing is, and it's the bit that actually we take for granted, is that there was a huge investment in the public sector. And it was an investment not so much in institutions or buildings, but in jobs. And so there were two areas. First, the expansion of government instrumentalities, like for the electricity and the gas and the water and building roads, for the first time started to employ full-time workers. Up till then, they'd depended a lot on gang labour, on short-term contracts, and so that's where the precariat was. And so for the first time in history, after the Second World War, unskilled men got permanent jobs that had holidays and sick pay, and they worked for organised, sometimes they got housing. Now, that's the first one. The second one was that they employed a huge number now of teachers, nurses, engineers in huge numbers in government instrumentalities. And what they actually did was build the middle class. And so the middle class that we have now was built by that massive government investment in professional services and administration.
As you point out, they reformed the economy from the factory to the farm.
Yes, and that's the other bit that we've got to think about now, that if we're going to reconstruct Australia, it has to be holistic in that way. I think very strongly that we've got to do a huge amount of work in regional and rural Australia.
So what happens was they trained hundreds of thousands of unskilled workers to be skilled workers, and we should also remember that we opened Australia to non-British migration.
Yeah, so we get that sort of great flood of talent coming in and energy, and migrants take risks which people who have grown up here often don't. But the other thing was that in Victoria, now it was worse than New South Wales, but they had to build 90 high schools in 20 years, and they didn't have the teachers. But they did invest in having teacher studentships, which were extremely generous scholarships, and you paid it back with a 3-year bond, and that paid you a real salary to go to university. So it was better for a working class kid to go to uni than it was to go and get a job.
So actually we see hope and a model by going back to these years.
That's right. And I think my thoughts on this really began listening to the younger members of my family and listening to their despair that there was no way forward, that there was no hope, that we were finished, usually expressed a lot more crudely than that. And I can't believe that. And I've done a lot of work on post-war society, particularly overseas. And when you think of what the state Europe was in, particularly in 1945, and how it rebuilt, that it's possible. Humans, people can do it. And they not only rebuilt physically, but in the EU and even in the Eastern Bloc countries, they built a better standard of living than they'd ever had before. And that's shown in life expectancy and all those sorts of things.
Janet, before we go back to Emma, I want you to remind the listeners what the Accord was. I remember thinking it was one of the most astonishing sort of double acts between government and the trade union movement that we'd ever seen or even imagined.
It was, and it had to first of all be worked out and then taken to Labor Party conference and taken to the ACTU. But what it did was have an agreement about prices and wages, but the partnership included business and private sector. And I vividly remember the summit and the sight of all these businessmen and representatives who were not Labor people there in the old Parliament House coming together. Now, I think that's what people want politicians to do. Climate change is so big, we can't do it from one party or one government. We have to have a bipartisan approach.
You're talking of a time back in, when the Accord was being cobbled together. Well, we had some fairly impressive people at the top. We had a fellow called Hawke, another one called Keating, and then there was Kelty. What a holy trinity.
It was. After a few years, they got it wrong. So they weren't infallible. And John Langmore became a very fierce critic of the way the Accord lost its way. And Keating never forgave him. They just wanted him to shut up in the party room. What we're arguing for is to say that the process of having an accord, an agreement, which in this case would be perhaps a commitment to a form of social contract based on the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, which would be principles of practice. Now, if you're a business and you want to be involved in this, or if you're a group of farmers and you want to be involved in this, you would have to sign up to agree to these principles of practice. But for that, you would then get access to funding and loans and tax cuts and support and mutual support and advice and so on. But if you didn't want to do that, if you thought, oh, no, that's far too socialist, well, then that's fine. You're not going to be forced to, but you're outside the tent. You just won't get anything.
I had the privilege of going to the summit.
Yeah.
I was representing the arts, would you believe? But if we did it again, we'd need to make it an even broader.
Absolutely.
Because the First Nations, I don't think, were represented.
No.
And farmers and smaller business, universities and research all need to have a place at the table.
Absolutely. And we start the book with a lovely essay by Thomas Mayer, because in a way the moral beginning has to be the Uluru Statement from the heart. And in many ways, well, I think in a very real way, the Uluru Statement and the principles and practices of Makarete, of reconciliation and agreement, treaty making, provide us with a model to do the summit. And that process of people learning to find consensus, and he has this beautiful description of the meeting when they finally found their consensus for the Uluru Statement, and everyone was in tears because no one could believe that the Aboriginal First Nations communities could ever agree on anything, and they had. They'd made it work. And
the response to that was the shameful brushing aside by Turnbull, which we cried again. Emma, back to you. Former deputy leader of the ALP, Jenny Macklin, builds on the idea of an accord, and she writes that Australia needs a 21st century emissions and employment accord, and this could help solve the twin challenges of sustainability and inequality. Tell me more.
Yes, look, this is a key concern of the book, and Jenny has been a good friend to Per Capita, the think tank that I lead in Melbourne, on these issues for some time now, certainly since leaving Parliament last year. So actually, Philip, we start, as Janet said, you know, she was having these conversations with John Langmore and others, and we were talking even before the pandemic, following the federal election last year, really, about the need for a modern Australian approach to reconstructing our economy in a way that would tackle these twin challenges, as we call them, so climate change and inequality. And we were harking back even then to the post-World War II reconstruction because, of course, in May this year it was the 75th anniversary of the tabling of the Curtin White Paper on full employment. And so that was a real focus for our team and certainly my conversations with Jenny about that. She gave a terrific lecture to the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence about 12 months ago where she outlined this idea of an employment and emissions accord. And really the recognition was following the election in 2019 that there had been fostered and fermented in the Australian public's mind this idea, this false idea, that you could either take action on climate change or you could have jobs and economic security.
Which is an absolute nonsense. In fact,
the opposite of the truth.
I want to quote a paragraph of Jenny's. Yeah. If you give Australians a reason to trust in a just transition and outcome, they will show remarkable courage and fortitude. I know they will, because that's what they did when Hawke, Keating and Kelty gave them a reason to trust in the future. Now, there's not a lot of trust around at the moment, though, Emma.
There isn't, and I think, and I'm often asked about this, and what, you know, what is it? Is it the media? Is it the news cycle? Is it social media? I think the answer is much simpler than that, and I think it's that we've broken the social contract. The idea that if you work hard and play by the rules and fulfil your own potential, that the state will be there to ensure that no one gets left behind and that you can have, in the Australian vernacular, a fair go and the opportunity of a good life. And I think social democratic parties around the world over the last 30 years have acquiesced to the notion of individualism and the pursuit of profit over our commonwealth. And so that social compact has been broken, and that's why people have lost that trust in the institutions of democracy, and that's what needs to be restored.
How do you think we should go about restoring it, Janet?
Well, I think the idea of an accord is a very important, powerful narrative to go to an election with. But the other part of it is that across business, people are coming to the same conclusion. They're far more worried about climate change than the government is. And they know things have got to change. And what I'd like to see is conversation starting across the country within communities. I've been talking to groups in the bush a bit, and, you know, people say, oh, look, this is the first time I've felt excited since about the 1970s that we could actually take this into our own hands, because if this is to work, it has to be devolved down to communities. If we've got to have a program developed for a region which is going to restore the land, protect against drought and fire, and get it producing effectively for its own particular ecology, that needs to come from those people because they're the experts.
I'm talking to the exec director of the progressive think tank Per Capita, Emma Dawson, and to author and historian Janet McCullman about the new book they've co-edited, What Happens Next? Reconstructing Australia After COVID-19. Emma, Albanese has also contributed an essay to this book. We've heard the budget reply, but are there some good ideas in his contribution?
Yes, there certainly are. I mean, he writes about his personal policy passion, which is infrastructure and investment for the reconstruction. And I think we heard some of those ideas in the budget reply the other night. But the thing I think was that's really interesting about his chapter is the focus on those parts of Australia that have been marginalised and left behind, on the regions and the outer suburbs. And people may see that as quite politically opportunistic or a political focus, because, of course, they were a lot of the regions that swung against Labor at the last election. But I think it's an absolutely valid concern, because I don't think anyone in those regions voted because they don't believe in climate change, or they love coal, or they want, or they hate renewables. But rather that those are the communities, the working communities, working class communities that have been on the forefront of every major disruption over the last four decades, whether that was privatisation or globalisation or automation of their jobs. They're constantly told they're the ones who have to take the fall for progress, who have to see their communities disrupted. So we need absolutely to recognise that progress without bringing people with us is no kind of progress at all. And so the investment in those communities is really, really important.
Janet, as an ageing farmer, can you talk about Emma Germano's ideas for sustainable agriculture and food production? I thought it was a pretty good effort.
It was a terrific effort. And she puts, you know, to the forefront the fact first that food is fundamental, and we don't take it seriously. I mean, neither party has policies about food and has it on their agenda. Secondly, the world is this year as hungry as it was in 1945. We've never had such shortages. And if Australia is to really get itself off coal, or maybe we should be replacing it with high-tech agriculture like they do in the Netherlands. Now, what she's saying is that, as you well know, the farmers are making a loss at the farm gate, and they can't afford to pay for their farm labour properly. So that really society, the government, needs to step in. And we can look at countries, poor countries, that have taken the step of having a nutritional floor guarantee, a sort of food guarantee or nutritional guarantee, where society subsidises food producers at the farm gate, not at the distributor's level or the supermarket, but to the farmers, to make their businesses viable so they can employ people properly, which is better for the workers, better for the farmers, and better for the communities. And that food remains affordable. And
well, farmers, of course, have a huge role to play in a low-carbon future, and we've got a lot of ground to cover. Not only ground, but water. Janet, water security, an area of concern?
Absolutely.
Terry Butler has some things to say about that in your book.
Yes, indeed. And look, you know, we face that the Murray-Darling Basin is likely to be about the worst affected area of populated Australia from climate change. It's going to have unbearable heat. The centre part of our whole ecology is now under severe threat. And so what we do about water is an absolute political nightmare. Margaret Simon's wonderful book on that and also her work on Penny Wong, this is going to be the toughest political nut to crack. There are so many vested interests and so many stakeholders and people. You know, it's like J.B. Galbraith talking about people and money. They become irrational about water because water is the staff of life and it sets off something in people.
Does anyone in the book think aloud about the Federation? Is that the appropriate system going forward?
No, they don't. Jay Weatherall does talk a lot, have an essay on deliberative democracy as a way of making our democracy more effective and more and closer to people. But, of course, we have the issue with Federation. It doesn't actually fit the ecological regions of the country. I mean, Aboriginal traditional society and all the language groups all match an actual specific ecology all over the country. And our modern grid doesn't do that, of course. So therefore, that's why environmental policy in the end has to be federal, that it's got to be holistic. And that's enormously difficult because of state conflicts. I mean, I'm just trying to think, you probably know the figure, but it's something extraordinary number, like 20 different authorities for dispersing water, agricultural water in New South Wales. It's an absolute administrative nightmare. I don't see the Federation being changed in a hurry. So I think we've just got to live with it and make the best of it.
Shireen Morris raises another political issue, the Republic. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so Shireen's chapter, I think, is a very thoughtful approach to the issue of the Republic. She writes about an affirmational republic and a way that we can pursue this idea in a way that will overcome the divisions that beset us the last time we attempted to achieve this through the referendum, of course, a couple of decades ago now. And I think she draws importantly on the idea, on the different ideas about Australian identity, so beginning with First Nations Australians, then to the idea of us being an outpost of Britain, but then also embracing multicultural Australia. And Shireen's, of course, got an exceptional background to understand this, having worked with Noel Pearson, but herself being a first-generation Australian from a non-English-speaking background. And her essay, I think, is a really thoughtful way of picking apart the policy approach and ensuring that we do this, again, as so much of the book advocates for, in a way that is community-driven and is really driven by the voices and the contributions of people to establish a process that would be, I think, a lot more likely to succeed than we tried the last time around.
Emma, so much to talk about, so little time. Manufacturing. We need to stop that hollowing out, don't we?
Absolutely. I mean, as Janet alluded to earlier, the creation of those good, secure jobs was what created the middle class. And once you hollow out the middle class, you get into all sorts of trouble. We've got terrific chapters in the book from Clinton Fernandez, Roy Green and Claire O'Neill on industry policy, manufacturing, industrial complexity and the need for us to have some sovereignty and some control over what we produce and what we make here. And I think the idea that a modern nation doesn't manufacture any goods or doesn't make anything has really been shown through this crisis to be very misguided. So that's absolutely critical.
Yes, our sort of insane reliance in recent years on the export of unprocessed raw materials is suddenly looking ill-considered, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. We're, I think, on a par with Uganda in terms of our industrial complexity. So certainly diversifying that economic base is really important to our security and prosperity.
Roy Green, Emeritus Professor Green, doesn't advocate for rejecting globalisation or returning to tariff protection, but he says we need a national industrial strategy.
Yes, and that's become quite a derided idea over recent years, that the government shouldn't be picking winners. I think Roy mounts a masterful case for why the government absolutely should be setting the parameters for industrial policy and a national strategy that gives business the certainty to invest. And that's quite a different thing than I would, if I can be so cheeky as to say the government's recent intervention is in picking losers with threatening to have a government-funded gas-fired power station when the rest of the market won't touch it. So I think Roy's argument's very sound, that there is a role for government really in setting the guidelines, setting the policies by which we know we can then invest with confidence.
I coined a word for tweeting today, and I was thinking about the government's attack on universities, and pan-academic occurred to me. Janet, we need to change our approach to universities, surely.
We do, and I think Stephen Parker's got a splendid essay on that the Dawkins reforms, where everything was meant to be the same, all universities were meant to be research universities, just doesn't work. It doesn't actually suit our people who need to go to university. So we've got to rethink it and have a much more diverse sector, have some universities which focus much more on research and others, particularly in regional areas, that do things that respond to their local area needs. But we need a much more flexible sort of transition from school to university and through TAFE and Technicology. Now, some of the universities do that, But we need a better and more open pathways. But the universities are actually facing a horrendous future at the moment. The loss, we have been operating, particularly the big universities like mine, operating as a huge Ponzi scheme or a pack of cards, and the cards have been pulled out from underneath, and these were the international student fees. We had this river of gold that came, and no one took the due diligence and corporate responsibility to say, well, maybe this won't always flow so strongly. Now, we have had an Asian financial crisis. We have had a GFC. Something might come to stop it, perhaps a pandemic. It closes the world down. And there was no prudence about creating sort of wealth funds or ways that could have seen the universities through. And even in the budget, where they gave $1 billion for research infrastructure, that is less than a quarter of what we've lost.
Well, let's once again remember that Curtin and Chifley made this centrepiece. They established our first research university, the ANU, to be a Princeton in the Pacific, and they inaugurated those wonderful Commonwealth scholarships and research funding.
Yes, and see, they really powerfully, strongly believed that they could only ensure the peace of the world through knowledge. And that's why the ANU particularly had a big focus on social science. Just not physical science, but social science even more than humanities. And they introduced, and new things came in, like demography. We became the leading place in the world for demography. I'm very proud of the ANU. I did my doctorate there. And then we had a School of Pacific Studies, that suddenly we were part of the Pacific, we were part of Asia, instead of a sort of dribbling on the end of the British Empire. And this is transformative over time. But the idea that you'd actually have a place devoted to research, well, they didn't necessarily have the staff yet to do that. Just as when we had to rebuild 90 high schools in Victoria, they didn't have the teachers. But, yes, education research, serious research, advanced research had to be the way forward.
As I walk into the studio, Emma and Janet, I pass a great big Radio National sign with a new theme, which is Think Bigger. And that, I think, links to what you two are so desperate for this nation to do. Thanks for coming on, Emma Dawson. Emma is Exec Director of Per Capita, which is a progressive think tank. Yes, there are actually a couple of those. And Janet McColeman is an award-winning author and historian. Their book, What Happens Next? Reconstructing Australia After COVID-19, published by Melbourne University Press, another one of those pesky universities.